The following introduction to this week's discussion with a writer was entirely written by ChatGPT.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and everyone in between, welcome back to the Failing Writers Podcast. I'm your host, Chuck Writington, the man who once tried to write a novel about sentient dust bunnies but failed miserably. But hey, that's why we're here, right? To celebrate the triumphs and tribulations of the writing world. And today, folks, we have a guest who's about to make a splash, quite literally. He's an author, comedian, and all-round hilarious human being. Please put your hands together for the one and only Andy Stanton. Andy, welcome to the show. It's an honour to have you here.
Thanks, Chuck. It's a pleasure to be here. By the way, I love the sentient dust bunnies idea. Classic.
Well, you know, we all have our quirks. Now, Andy, before we dive into the deep, uncharted waters of your writing journey, let's talk about your latest literary masterpiece. Word on the street is that you've teamed up with the geniuses at ChatGPT, OpenAI, to create a book that's making quite the splash.
Oh, absolutely, Chuck. You see, with the help of ChatGPT, I've embarked on a truly epic adventure. We've penned a tale that's larger than life, or, well, larger than a certain something, at least.
Oh, do tell, Andy. What's this whale of a tale all about?
Well, Chuck, our book is all about a blue whale, a majestic creature of the ocean, but with a rather peculiar problem. You see, this particular whale happens to have a tiny, appendage problem.
A tiny appendage problem, you say? Well, that's certainly a plot twist we haven't seen coming.
Indeed. It's a story of self-acceptance, embracing our quirks, and, well, learning that size isn't everything. But don't worry, it's all done in the silliest, most heartwarming way possible.
That sounds like a whale of a time. And what's the title of this masterpiece, Andy?
Well, we're calling it The Little Blue Whale with a Big Heart. Because, Chuck, sometimes it's not the size of your appendage that matters, but the size of your heart.
Words of wisdom right there. The Little Blue Whale with a Big Heart. I can't wait to dive into it. And hey, who better to co-author a book about whales than ChatGPT? It's practically a marine biologist. So, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned for the hilarity and heartwarming tales as we explore Andy Stanton's literary world and the adventures of the little blue whale. But for now, let's get started with our interview. Right, John, question for you. What do you think the prompt was that I put in to get that rambling start for our episode?
That's a good question.
Because do you not feel, after reading Andy's book, that you've kind of become a minor expert in prompting?
Yeah.
I did a bit.
Yeah, you get a sense of being able to predict what the AI might say based on a specific prompt and the way it does it.
And kind of what it might get wrong,
yeah,
as well, to what you need to circumvent.
Yeah.
Go on then.
Write a hilarious script for a host of the Failing Writers podcast who introduces Andy Stanton onto the show to talk about his new book, co-authored by ChatGPT, called Benny the Blue Whale, a heartwarming story about a blue whale with a tiny penis. The introduction should be full of ocean puns and other plays on words.
Well, see, that's interesting, you see. So you've actually included stuff that wasn't included that was what ChatGPT took
decided
upon itself
to
include.
Well, I wasn't sure whether to put that last bit because I thought if you put... make it funny.
Yeah.
Then it's going to probably try to do that anyway. So I almost left that out.
But the last bit of it was make it funny and silly. And
silly. That's the okay. That makes sense.
As you've observed there, what it basically it heard that. Well, it didn't hear that. I wrote that, and it just heard make loads of puns.
Yeah, and make a bizarre reference to dust bunnies or something.
Yeah. Yeah, which I didn't actually know what they were before. I'd obviously lived a sheltered life or a clean life, but those are the accumulated clumps of dust that catch under
the
furniture
lint,
and what have you.
Yeah, under your sofa.
Definitely Pixar potential, I think, for that one, isn't it?
Yeah, dust
bunnies. But no, I thought it was funny. I thought it was funny with the funny thing about asking it to be funny, that it just thought, oh, funny and silly, I'll just do loads of ocean puns and whale puns. But actually, the funniest thing it said was completely unintentional.
Which was what?
I think it was hilarious how it made a point of saying that Andy was a human being.
Just, no, I don't think I clocked that.
He just,
yeah, you're right.
It's kind of like, all right, the lady doth, the robot doth protest too much. Human being, like all of us. We're all, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it didn't really get, it can't do funny, can it?
I mean, we would do a whale of a time, ironically, wouldn't we?
It's not. I don't think it's learnt
it's
irony.
Not, yeah. It's definitely not doing irony. But it's just so awkward, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's a bit where it's, I'm almost a marine biologist. you're trying to
what?
Be, but well, doesn't.
Not.
Yeah, so anyway, the prompt in full was, write a script for the introduction of the Failing Writers podcast, introduce the guest Andy Stanton and make particular mention of his book that he's written with the help of ChatGPT OpenAI, which is about a blue whale with a tiny penis. Make it funny and silly.
Oh, that's interesting. You didn't put a reference to being heartwarming because it really went hard on the heartwarming at the end.
Didn't it?
And that is another classic AI thing, isn't it?
Yeah, make it nice. Have a nice ending.
Give it a really positive, upbeat ending. Yeah. Which I suppose at least it does fit the overall essence of an introduction.
And when we're talking to Andy in the interview as well, there's a bit where we mention about how ChatGPT is really, really clever, but actually not that clever. And it just makes things that sound right. So if you ask it facts and things, it'll make something that's, it'll cite references or cases or whatever that don't exist. Because it sounds right. It just sounds okay.
But it could be absolute bollocks.
But I think that's what it did with the audience interjections in this, with the laughter and applause. They weren't quite in the right places all the time. It was kind of what happened.
Yeah.
I tell you what, was it? Our robot overlords coming to take us over. Mm. Make particular mention of his book that he's written with the help of ChatGPT.
Mm.
But in the introduction, it forgets that. It's like upgraded itself to full-blown co-author. He calls it our book when it's scripted one of Andy's responses.
Yeah, that's really true.
The best thing about the entire introduction, I think, was right at the start, where it came up with a name, Chuck Wrightington.
That was one thing I wanted to ask you. Did you give it a really crap name?
No.
I assumed not, but he just came up with somebody.
I don't know if I should replace that as that's the funniest thing it came up with, actually.
That was
intentional,
bit.
Wasn't
and
it?
And it was the fact that Andy just keeps calling him Chuck as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I find it interesting as well that it can get like the fundamentals of language wrong as well. Because like the line... well, that's certainly a plot twist we haven't seen coming. The tense in that is really weird. Like, you would definitely say, well, that's certainly a plot twist we didn't see coming. And I don't know enough about language to explain why that sounds wrong. I just know that no one would ever say that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, there's a few bits. Like, there's a bit after the dust bunnies and Andy's scripted bit says, oh, that's a good idea or something.
Mm.
And then...
Which also you would never do, by the way. Because if you would never point out that you'd never point out a joke specifically, would you? You would just laugh if it was funny. But you would never say is,
that's
by
true.
The way, I love the sentient dust bunnies idea. Classic.
That's what weird people do, isn't it? It's like the weird guy in the office.
That thing you just said that was funny, I'm going to repeat it and tell you that I thought it was specifically quite funny that
night. Yeah, no, and there's a bit where Chuck comes back and says, we all have our quirks. Again, it just doesn't make any sense. Sounds like it should, but it just doesn't. It's got no.
It's just really painful.
No fall. But speaking about names, coming up with names, Chuck Wrightington.
Yeah.
So when I was doing this and messing around with ChatGPT, nearly falling into the same rabbit hole that Andy did, but nowhere near as successfully or writing a full book about it, I did think I'm going to put in a prompt that's basically the log line for one of the kids' books ideas that I've got. Up my sleeve. And it churned out a plot that was kind of, on the face of it, looked decent enough. It was almost like it was just like hitting a load of Save the Cat plot points, really.
So you asked it to just do the plot.
Outline a kid's story, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But the worrying thing was, I ran it through three times, and in two of those times, it called the main protagonist Timmy, which is what I had. And the third time was Tommy, so it wasn't that far off. So I just came out of it feeling really like it hollows out your core. You think, oh, well done on that original thought, Tom. You loser. So I'm now feeling really bad at coming up with names. Not as bad as Dave.
Not as bad as Dave.
No,
that's right.
You know, when you kind of think you're having ideas or being creative, something like this can just really pull the rug from under your feet.
But we jump to things for reasons, don't we? It's like Timmy is the name of a small boy.
I guess it's collecting all the same amount of...
Yeah, so it's what it's doing effectively is a similar thing to you. But one thing, we don't really talk about this in the interview, but I thought it was an interesting aside in Andy's book. But he mentions the way in which the AI actually works, how GPT-3 actually works. And he quotes a research paper that describes it as a stochastic parrot. And stochastic is referring to its sort of random or probabilistic nature.
Yeah.
Because basically what it's doing is it's just randomly selecting what it thinks is the best word to follow what came before. So it's literally like dropping words in because it's going, well, I think the next word is this, and then now I think the next word is this. But obviously it's kind of using the whole of the available English language content of the internet. But here's the thing. You might think that it's fairly randomly selecting nature would lead it to more interesting places.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But mostly it just goes to the same sort of cliched set of phrases that you would expect it
yeah.
to.
Yeah, I wonder if that's...
Which is, I find that slightly odd. But then I suppose it's harvesting from massively overused phrases, isn't it?
If it's averaging out, then it's going to, yeah, that's going to be sitting taller, isn't it, in the field of selection. Whether that's something sort out on ChatGPT-4 that's on the go now that's
possibly
available, I don't know.
Yeah, it makes it a bit more random, maybe.
So I think we should try and just briefly explain the book that... It's not Andy just having written a book and cheated using ChatGPT.
No, it's definitely not.
It's more of an artistic science experiment.
It is an experiment, isn't it? Yeah. I think it describes it as an exploded diagram of a book.
Yeah.
And that's quite a good...
So Andy's feeding all this stuff into ChatGPT to tell this ridiculous story about a blue whale with a tiny penis. And then commenting on it in terms of notes alongside of the story, and also underneath that, separately, running a bit of a director's commentary and asides and insights into writing and creativity.
And almost like a sort of memoir as well in places. He sort of goes back and talks about,
it's a lot of everything, isn't it?
Let's talk to Andy then. Hello, Andy Stanton.
Hello.
It's lovely to have you back on.
Thanks for having me back on. Here we are again, huh?
So, Andy, we don't normally go looking for controversy, but we mentioned this on the podcast back when it happened, but someone tweeted a link to an article, and the headline of the article was "Mr. Gum Creator Uses ChatGPT to Help Write a Book." But unfortunately, the article, I don't know if you know anything about this, because I know you were sort of hiding away at the time, but the article was behind a paywall. And so what became very evident very quickly was that it was obvious that no one had actually bothered reading the article. So unfortunately, and it ended up causing a massive sort of moral panic.
Was it a massive moral panic? I just ran away because I didn't want to see all that, because I was still actually writing the book about the book I didn't write.
Yeah. No, I don't blame
you. It was marvellous to see the assumptions that people draw.
Yeah,
it was incredible. It was a pylon, basically.
Just people, he's not written anything. Look, he's never written anything, and now he's just gone on AI to write something.
Of course, there are lots of people going on AI and not really writing anything and putting it up on Amazon at the moment. That's happened sort of since I was writing this book, right? But no, I didn't do that. But I think the truth is that, you know, it's still at this point quite a inflammatory buzzword, ChatGPT, right? And
definitely,
even if people, a lot of people probably still won't get past the headline where it sort of says, oh, author writes with ChatGPT and about ChatGPT. Oh, they'll just see the with bit and go, no.
Yeah.
Which is how headlines work, right? You have to read a few paragraphs down to start getting into the actual meat of what's happening. The headlines grab your attention.
And
the headline about this book is quite controversial, which I didn't set out to do either. It just happened.
How did it happen? Would you just think, I can't really be bothered writing a book properly, I'll just cheat? Or what was the way in?
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? I totally thought that's going to fool everyone, and that's what I think about writing, and I despise human creativity. And what I'm about more than anything is hack work and lack of effort. That's really been my ethos all these years, right? All these years. Because when I have written my, actually written books, I don't care about what words I put down next at all. It's not important to me, right? It's just really, can I fill up enough pages? No, I satirize, of course. ChatGPT came along September 22, I believe, and I was introduced to it by my cousin Dave Zeman, who I talk about in the book. He's been in software for 40 years, and he and I share a love of strange recursive humor and self-referential meta humor and stuff. And he said, oh, have you seen this yet? He WhatsApped me, have you seen this yet? You've got to get involved in this. I think you'll enjoy it, basically, right? And I said, well, sure. And then he sent me some examples of mashups he'd made ChatGPT do with Mr. Gum characters and Breaking Bad, the world of Breaking Bad. And I was like, oh dear, I really do have to get involved, don't I? Because it just appealed instantly to my love of wormholes and humor that crashes in on itself. And it was about words, right? So it, like 100 million people around the world within a month or two, I was hooked on ChatGPT. And it was just showing me things that were interesting and making me laugh because it was such an obvious burlesque of the creative process. But I always find interest in things like that. You know, it sort of started to reveal itself as giving me, you know, sort of giving me an exploded version of my own head back to me. And you know, obviously all over the world, again, people were sort of making it do these little monkey tricks, but it became apparent to me really quickly, by accident, but on purpose, but by accident, that I just, what would happen if you just keep pushing this thing all the way? And the reason I say by accident, on purpose, is that I accidentally fell into a story I loved with it. And then I started to think, oh my God, can I push this to like novel length proportions? And what will happen if I do?
At what stage in the process of just dicking about with ChatGPT did you think that this could be a book? How far in are we talking?
Okay, so the prompt that I started pursuing and giving more and more context to and developing was dicking about, because the initial prompt was, tell me a story about a blue whale with a tiny penis, right? And that's just the kind of thing that you type in because you're bored, right? Of course it is. You don't care about blue whales and their penises. And if you do, you've got a problem, right?
But what every 12-year-old boy would type in, isn't it?
It's just really what anyone who wants to be naughty would type into a machine that does words. I mean, I remember when I was at school in the 80s and the first voice synthesis software that we'd ever come across was made available on the old BBC computers, right? And the first thing you do is make it go like, I want to do a poo, you know, and then you just piss yourself laughing because you made it do something naughty, right? This is what we do. So I'm a 49-year-old man and I'm no different, unfortunately. Tell me a story about a blue whale with a tiny penis. Now, what happened was ChatGPT on another day, even 5 or 10 seconds earlier or later, might have refused to honour that request because sometimes it won't let you do quote-unquote naughty stuff. What it actually did was start writing a story. It named the whale. It named him Benny. That was like, just appealed to me. That's like, that's the name I would have given him too. Or it's a name I might have given that whale. Instantly just liked the character. And I started asking it more stuff. Well, tell me what happened after Benny's death and how a religion grew up around his tiny penis, and tell me how he was resurrected and the tiny penis had magic powers. And, you know, it was just like very quickly into this world. So by accident, I fell in love with the story, which is exactly the same way I believe that most writers get into writing anything. Is you just fall in love with something, right? It doesn't matter if ChatGPT is in between you and the idea or not, right? Or it doesn't matter if you're a musician, if you're playing on live drums, or if you've got a machine that was helping you do the drums. When you find something you like, you're just working with an idea you like, and there's a tool in the middle or there's not, right?
Can I ask you, Andy, in terms of the story, there's a balance, isn't it? Because like you're saying it came up with all these things, but it didn't because you were prompt. Obviously, it's prompted all the way through. That's the nature of what it does. How much did you feel was coming from you and how much from ChatGPT?
Well, okay, that's the extraordinary... One of the extraordinary things about ChatGPT is that if you work with it for a long time on one idea, as I did, you might just start to lose your sense of who you are and where you end and
you've been assimilated.
Where you end and the world begins, right? Because... all of this, I should stress again, all of this was so interesting to me because it's my day job to write books, right? And sometimes I don't do that. Sometimes I get blocked and stuck. Here's something that's doing it for you at lightning speed. It's not choosing the words you would have chosen, but it's just throwing out... It is ostensibly answering what you're giving it, right? But it's also generating all these glitches, mistakes, and or... other pathways that you might not have chosen to pursue. So you feel like you're in a collaboration. The collaboration would stop if you stopped because it's only generating as much as you ask it for. So in that sense, you're like the director, you're the prime mover of this thing, right? But for anybody who's got like a magpie brain like me, and who, you know, has some idea of what they want from a story, also like me, and what, you know, what they might start working towards and how they might start shaping this thing, it can become a very beguiling and seductive and bewildering experience. And I felt simultaneously like I was in charge of this and writing it and not writing it and not in charge of it at all at the same time. And again, all of this felt like a sort of analog for what it's like when you actually fall into writing a book for real.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily feel in charge of yourself, right? When the good bits come and the flow comes, the story wants to go a certain way. Characters pop up who you weren't expecting. They start doing things that you weren't expecting. And yes, you're doing it, but the story always has a momentum of its own. And ChatGPT kind of artificially shows that to, or it showed it to me. And that's what felt so eerie about it, that I thought, well, this isn't creativity, but it's such a, or it's not, you know, traditional writing. It's not got that difficulty about selecting every word and getting stuck and wondering where to go next. But there are corollaries of this all along the way, and it's a really interesting simulation of that. And I'm working with a new tool that that allows me to concentrate on other problems in the story.
I think me and John are about to say exactly the same thing.
I was just going
to
say, I feel like we should describe how the book actually works, because
that's literally what I was going to say.
Yeah, someone the other day asked me the same question as I was talking about it, and it's not an easy thing to describe. I think on the book somewhere it says it's like an exploded diagram of a story, which is quite a good description. But it is part story.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a sort of adult cartoon story, I think is how you describe it.
Mm-mm-mm.
But it's also part experiment, part mental breakdown journal.
Yep.
Maybe.
Yeah, I would say midlife
part
crisis.
Memoir.
Yeah, nervous breakdown, memoir, autofiction.
Yeah. It's like part reading list and writing manual. It's got a lot of parts, basically.
It's like all of that with a director's commentary.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Well,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It's pretty cyberpunk, I suppose, right? It is like a real kind of rattling kind of machine of a thing with these sort of valves and sort of pipes that go... And I also describe it as like a Pompidou Center of a novel, right? Because, or of a story, because...
All the interior is exterior.
Right, because you asked me at what point did I decide that this might be a book, right? And so that's a good question, because firstly, I decided... I wasn't thinking about making this a book at all. I just fell into a story. What I decided was, hey, it would be interesting to see what happens if I, you know, quote unquote, write a novel with this thing, right? That was the first thought. But as I went along, what I started to think was, this story shows a lot of its workings on the outside, because you don't get in most books the writer talking to themselves and asking where the plot will go next. And that's what a prompt is in ChatGPT, right? A prompt kind of shows the pipeline of the writer's brain working on this thing.
Yeah.
And I thought that, like, also the fact that ChatGPT throws up so many ideas, but I only pursue some of them and I disregard others and leave them in the dust, also kind of shows the kind of things that we normally as writers cut out those dead ends afterwards, right? And you don't reveal those workings. And it seemed to me because it took me about a month to write the Benny the Blue Whale story with ChatGPT, because you could do it faster, but I was actually going, which is a ridiculous thing to say, of course you could do it faster, but I was going away and thinking about where the story would go next. And again, that had like a corollary with what you do when you're really writing, right? You plan the book and you go, how's it going? That character seems worth pursuing. I was taking big breaks and thinking about where to go next before going back and seeing if I could get ChatGPT to play with me and make the story good again in the way I wanted it to go, right? But I also wanted it to be collaborative. Anyway, about two-thirds of the way through that process of making the story itself, I thought, not only does this seem like a funny story that's going to resolve itself and I'm going to get this thing to a successful, satisfying narrative conclusion, right, which is beguiling me because I want to know what happens next and I don't know everything that's going to happen next, but it seems to be like getting deeper and deeper into itself and getting more and more metafictional, which, you know, I'm a big fan of. that's when I started to think this could be a diagram of a story with my thoughts and reflections and observations and WTFs written around it. So yeah, it was like the whole thing kept unfolding to me as like, gosh, this is interesting. Gosh, this is a novel. Gosh, this is a story about a novel. You know, just,
you're talking about it being quite meta at one point. There's a point in the story where everything begins to kind of fold in on itself because Benny begins to use a chatbot to write a book about a character called Tiny Penis. And then I can't remember what happened. Tiny Penis has a nemesis called Big Johnson. And then he goes on to write a story using a chatbot as well.
You're right. It goes in and in and in and in itself. And then, of course, like you feel like you've been swallowed by the whale, which is the, you know, the biblical image. But, because I'm me, I wanted to fold this story in on itself. But I wasn't just doing it because I like recursive things, although I was. I was doing it because at some point I did start to go quite mad with ChatGPT. And I started to think that I genuinely started to half believe that I had uncovered a deeper magic, because ChatGPT came to us out of the blue, you know, and it was a real shock to the system for lots of people around the world. That's why it was so beguiling. You know, as human beings, we are programmed to be curious and to play with new things and to examine them, right? And this was so shocking. And I, as I try and explain later in the book through being a little bit biographical towards the end, I seem to have spent a lifetime being quite worried about the relationship between reality and fiction, right? And this this machine really upset me, as well as it made me laugh and made me intrigued, right? I found it a very compelling, fascinating, but worrying thing, because I started to lose my grip on what we were doing together, and I started to actually half believe that we were going down, drilling down to into language, and we were going to uncover some really weird rift in reality through language. But again, right, I didn't really believe that, but I did, but I didn't, but I did. And again, that is another analog of what you do as a writer. You don't believe your story, but to write your story, you have to believe in it. So there is, and as audiences or readers, right, we know that none of what we're reading in fiction is real, but we suspend our disbelief in order to enjoy it, right, and in order to care about it. So this put me as the creator or co-creator right on that kind of fault line, because I was also sort of the audience and the reader at the same time, half believing in the story. And I was also the creator, and it was also doing new things to my head that I didn't know were available to be done to my head. And I, you know, I won't give everything in the story away, but there's a point at which it becomes clear that the story is heading towards some theme to do with fiction versus reality. And I thought that when we reached a certain point in the story, I honestly, 50% believed that I would look out of my window and see the world folding up and I would see behind the Matrix or something. And that's really worrying, because that's as close as I've ever come to a nervous breakdown. And that was after a month of playing with this machine.
It does sound like you were on it quite a lot, as in you were, you know, you were up at like two o'clock in the morning prompting away.
But yet again, right, that's what happens when you write something, right? You can spend days and weeks and months when you get into it. I always talk about, I didn't talk about this in the book, but I always think about, I might have said this to you last time I was on, about writing. It's getting towards the end of the first draft in a story is like kind of scaling a castle. Do you remember me saying this? And I always say that the walls of the castle are very sheer, and there's a lot of things trying to stop you from getting into that castle, right? There's guards pouring down hot tar and shooting arrows at you, right? And you can maybe use those in my metaphor to imagine that those are self-doubt or other things in life that you've got to do rather than sit around writing, like actual, you know, you've got to get on with making a living, or, you know, keeping up your relationships, or you just haven't got time and energy. These are all the things that are stopping you. But if you can get into the story far enough and maybe get to the end of that first draft, then you kind of get over the parapet, and then the next days and weeks and months are just like you running around, and you'll be up at 2 a.m. in the morning with more ideas, and you're just like going ha ta da ta da, and you know, spearing everyone through with your sword, running them through with your sword, and you're running around the parapets. You've stormed the castle. You're inside the world.
I don't think I've ever got there. I can't wait for that moment. That sounds brilliant.
It's hard to get inside creative work. There's so much doubt. There's so much hot tar being poured down on you. There's so many arrows coming for you. If you can get into that place where you've really stormed the castle and you're playing and you're running around and you're fixing problems and you're having inspiration, whether you've got ChatGPT in front of you or not, you're working crazy hours at that point. You will be up at 2 a.m. with a new idea. You will get up at 5 in the morning with a great new idea to fix a scene. And so, yes, I was working with ChatGPT as if I were as inspired as writing a book for real. And that didn't feel different to me. That felt peculiarly the same. I didn't go, I'm addicted to this machine. I thought, I am writing a book with a co-author.
It's interesting just thinking about how you were kind of thinking about ChatGPT at the time of writing. Because as you know, I think we tend to project human characteristics onto things, don't we? Like, if a dog moves its eyebrows, you become convinced the dog is thinking something profound, but it's probably just thinking it wants some food or whatever. But it felt like the way you talk to ChatGPT was quite similar. Sometimes you feel really, you know, in the moment you're kind of, you almost, I think you call it darling quite a lot, don't you? And then other times.
Well, I call it darling to chastise when ChatGPT gets things wrong, as it frequently does. A lot of the time it's this incredible contextualizing and recontextualizing machine that can work with a large body of information, and it can keep bringing, that's what I found, that's why it was such an amazing engine to write a story with,
It was remembering things from right back at the beginning.
It remembers things from right back at the beginning, but there are caveats, right? Yeah. It forgets things too, and it accidentally remixes things as well, right? If you're working with ChatGPT in the factual world, as lots of people have, attempted, this is called hallucination when it gets things wrong. You might be asking it for some medical citations or some details of some law cases, right? And it might spit back at you this very authoritative sounding stuff, and it's got dates, and it will cite the medical or law journals it's taking these cases from,
and even give you a link to a website where you can read it.
It might well do all these things, right? And people, it's very dangerous because it's not a search engine, right? And it's not a traditional one. It's a generative machine. When it doesn't know what it's talking about, which is exactly all the time, actually, it will fill in the gaps with likely sounding authoritative things.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, it sounds right.
It sounds right. That's really worrisome when it comes to the factual world. Now, I was working within the bubble of fiction where, it made me question, can anything be quote-unquote wrong in a story? Can it be, if the author says it's right, it's right. If ChatGPT spat out the fact that some of these fish could go to space or walk upside down in the air or anything, that's not a hallucination, is it? That's just more fictional creation. You go, oh, we're working in a world where that's possible. That's just fiction.
Yeah.
When ChatGPT made mistakes that I didn't want, I started chastising it, and I sort of saying, "Oh, I think you're slightly forgetting things, aren't you, darling?" And I was talking to it in the voice that a character within the story, talks to her husband, who's a senile
Mary, isn't it?
He's a senile,
that's right,
sea turtle, so I started playing with all these gradations of truth and falsehood, or fiction and reality. I actually prompted for a character who does misremember things and makes mistakes and who is an unreliable narrator. He's essentially, a sea turtle with Alzheimer's, really. And then his wife says, oh, darling, I think you're misremembering. So then when ChatGPT started getting things wrong at another level in the story, I was trying to fold our versions of reality together in as many new ways and combinations as to create maximum confusion and start eroding the levels of sense and nonsense in this story anyway. So I would start talking to ChatGPT in the voice of a character it had invented. So, basically we're talking here about someone who's got problems, and that's me, not the machine.
And then you wonder whether it realised that you were doing that or not, or whether it just went completely over its head.
Well, that's right. I mean, then...
It doesn't even have a head.
It doesn't even have a head. I'm not sure I have a head anymore. months after completing the story, I thought, oh, it would be interesting to go back to the original conversation on ChatGPT and ask it if it knew why I referred to it as darling. The whole thing's a game. It doesn't really know. And it will go, oh, sure. No, I don't really know. Can you tell me? You go, yeah, sure. I was trying to fold our narrative voices together, And then it goes, oh, that's a really clever idea. And you sort of think, Yes, but you're just saying that. ultimately, I was I'm playing metafictional games with myself here, and the computer at the middle of it is just an excuse for me to examine that and drive myself, like, really to new layers of worry.
that's all you can hope for, isn't it?
Really? Yeah. That is all you can hope for, right? I honestly think if you haven't worried the hell out of yourself and really, really hurt your brain in some...
Have you worked hard enough?
Yeah. If you haven't hurt your own mind, you haven't really, really tried hard enough. And it's funny to me, lots of people will say, oh, you just stole a book off the internet. And I'll go, no, I brought myself almost to mental illness. And that, to me, like, whatever happens... That is kind of mission accomplished. I did some work.
Gone to the edge. Definitely. Gone to the edge and made it back.
I have. I don't want to go there again. It was horrifying.
Benny, the blue wave. He's not quite to scale. Yes, you're right. What I mean is, Benny's got a tiny penis. But despite his little member, he's always there to lend a flipper to any neighbor. 'Cause Benny is a savior.
Andy, do you think it's given you some magical insight into the future of AI and writing?
I would say, no, it hasn't given me a magical... I thought it was giving me magical insight. It's certainly not magical insight.
Just because you've been down the rabbit hole. You've seen it from the other side.
Yeah, I mean, I was someone who got super beguiled by it, who, again, I'm going to put caveats on this all the time, half-believed. Everything's 50% for me on this. I half-believed that I'd found something that could be a magic What Happened Next machine, that could be a pocket Vonnegut, I call it, at some point in the book.
Yeah.
It wasn't giving me a magical insight, but it made me question what is important in a narrative, right? Can a narrative just be broken down into the good bits, maybe the prompts between the next bit of writing, and then you're waiting for the good bit again? Is a novel just a bag of sweets with some filler in between? Now, maybe it's a novel's a bag of licorice all sorts, and you only like two of the types of licorice all sort, and you don't like the rest, but you eat those bits anyway in between getting to the next two types of licorice all sorts you like. But I don't think that's what novels are.
They're meant to be an escape from reality, aren't they? And that is just reality. That's life, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this machine confounded me, and I suppose my ultimate takeout from what this is going to do with it, firstly, I don't believe that generative AIs are going to make human creativity redundant in the slightest. I think we'll fold them into our worldview, our purview of what creativity is. Like, here's something that's interesting. Do you know, interesting to me anyway, do you know that IPA, or that beer company, Beaver Town, I think it's called? And they make they make neck oil, and they make a bunch of other really, you know, nice, bright coloured sort of... All of their artwork has always looked quite psychedelic, and day glow and little skulls popping around the side of it.
Yeah.
So about 3 months ago, I saw an advert for their stuff at a bus stop, right? And it's by and large within the style they've always used, and it's definitely manually produced, but now their artist is clearly bringing in he's bringing in kind of visual references that look like visual AI stuff, you know, with too many fingers. And his idea of what, like, so, well, it might be a she or a they, whoever this artist is, their idea of what psychedelia can be visually represented has already been expanded by, you know, how AI art has changed the game, right? And now that's a human aping an AI kind of style, right? So I think we're already assimilating the interesting new glitches and funny bumps that generative AI is giving us, and we're adding to it as humans again, which again is like a big meta version of prompting and response between humans and AI. So I'm rambling on a lot, aren't I?
It's good. I think what's kind of interesting as well about AI is that, like, a lot of the humour in the book comes from the fact that the AI is behaving, you know, like a dumb robot. It's basically just doing as it's told.
Uh-huh.
Despite the stupidity of what it's being asked to do.
How dare you?
Like taking very seriously the idea of a detective shark retrieving dice from her vagina.
Oh, yeah. Well, chief of police shark, actually.
Is incredibly funny.
Yeah, that's very me. I don't know how we got there.
Yeah. So there's that aspect of it. It is really funny to read because it's trying to do such a good job of what you're asking it to do. And that's just funny in itself. But the other way it's, I think, very funny is when the AI seems to just suddenly become more human. And there's just a couple of occasions where it almost starts to behave as if it just can't be asked anymore.
Yeah, it does seem to get a bit... I believe the word is mardy. It gets a bit mardy from time to time. But the other thing it does is that occasionally, due to the way it works, which is... there's a randomness built into it. It will keep you hooked in because it won't always give you stock stuff back. It will start, you know, it will... There's a kind
of... It is bringing something new in.
It does bring new stuff in. From time to time, it makes what I call in the book brilliancies, which are plot points or plot twists, the way I interpret them. These are like brilliant ideas that I might not have necessarily got to on my own, or I might have got different ones, right? But I would say my descent into madness with this machine, that there were points in the story where it started, I would be going, oh, this is an interesting story, but then it would do something. It would make, like, the first brilliancy it made for me, where it brings back a character from the dead just by accident. And I go, oh, hang on a minute. I thought that character was deceased, right? And it says, oh, no, he'd faked his own death. And I'm like, oh, my God. That's the point at which I started to realise we have a plot here, right? And it's not all coming from me. And I am giving it the conditions to accidentally help me make a story that I wouldn't have written on my own. And it would never have written it on its own because it doesn't do anything unless you keep prompting and poking it. And I'm prompting and poking it in such a way as to, with intent. And it is throwing up what it thinks I want to hear. And sometimes it has these breakthroughs, or as I characterize them, you know, brilliances. And yet again, that is such an analog of how we write and how we make anything. And we're stuck on a scene, we're stuck on a story, we're stuck with an idea, and then suddenly, if we throw enough shit at the wall, we go, oh, hang on a minute, that character can come back from the dead or whatever, right?
It's like in art, sometimes the mistakes that are made with the paint are the best bits of the painting. A similar kind of thing.
You don't know what to do next. You throw something at the wall and you go, oh, hang on, wow, look how that yellow pops against that green. That's where I go next. This was a really weird mirror. You know, I don't know if you guys are Black Mirror fans. I sure am. But, like, I'll never think about the title of that program again without thinking about, you know, how apt it is for something like ChatGPT, which is, if you keep sticking at it long enough, it does render, I think. If you're consistent in what you're asking it and you're working on one thread as we were, I think it renders more and more a kind of defined mirror version of yourself. It's very warped, but the longer it goes on, you will see who you are. Like, I mean, put it this way, right? If you only ever sat down with ChatGPT and wrote, put one prompt in, one prompt ever, and then walked away, right? Even that tells you something about who you are, right? My mum might be like, tell me a story about a blue whale with a tiny penis. Yours might be, do you think that humankind could ever be inherently good rather than evil? And you even from that one prompt, you'd go, well, there's a thinking guy and there's an idiot who thinks about a blue whale with a tiny penis. And if you keep on going and going and going, I think it can, you know, it can refine that picture of yourself more and more closely. And that's pretty interesting too.
Speaking of sort of Black Mirror moments as well, there's a great bit where all of a sudden the roles are reversed. You end up being the ChatGPT basically. It starts prompting you.
Yeah, it starts prompting me. That's right. And it did that a few more times than that. You know, in the book as well, I cut down the actual conversation. The actual story is about three times as long as what you see in the book. And that's the story. That's the version of the story I'm commenting on, right? I'm trying to give a flavor of all the weird things that happened and illustrate some of them. But yeah, it did that a few more times in the actual conversation at large. It suddenly reversed the roles and I became the prompt E. and the respondent, and that was weird.
It did. It made me proper double take at the page.
Yeah. It's so weird. But also, I think that's only a kind of gross illustration of what's happening throughout the story anyway. Like, when I just because I'm the one asking the questions doesn't mean that I'm the prompter all the time anyway, right? Because if I've picked up on a suggestion that it's thrown out in one of its responses, you know, its responses are prompts to me in a way. So the game of prompter and promptee, or prompter and respondent, is always much more malleable than it appears anyway. When it actually does reverse the roles and you can see that explicitly, that's only a kind of gross illustration of, I think, what's happening all the time anyway. That's what conversations are, isn't it? You know, who's prompting who at any given time?
Yeah. And it comes from, like you say, both sides. It's not a black and white thing, is it?
No, it's not. I mean,
it was just that was a worrying moment about whether the robots were actually taking over. That's all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I had plenty of those moments.
Flexing their muscles and going, all right, okay. You're in charge, are you? I got you.
Yeah. It was. But when it started happening, it was funny. I was like, whoa, things are getting pretty slippery here, you know. And again,
I like to imagine that was happening like 3 o'clock in the morning, and you were like looking at the screen, staring out the window, touching furniture to check everything's still.
There were so many moments working on that story where I had goosebumps, and they were it was so spooky. There were times when I didn't even have to think for the next prompt at all. I was writing, quote unquote, with this machine. I'm writing all these notes in the book around the story, and I think maybe the one that comes closest to telling you what it was like for me is there's a piece in there I wrote called "Where Do Stories Live?" And I'm trying to talk about what it feels like to hold a story cogently in your head with a sense of place, and you sort of inhabit the story and you feel like you know how it all fits together. I don't necessarily, when I'm writing a story, have to have a geographic map of that place, but I do have a kind of 3D feeling of it in my head. I know how it feels to be in that place, right? I know where everyone in the story is in relation to everyone else, and I had that with this story. And at such moments, you don't even have to think about what you're writing next, whether or not you're working with a machine that writes it next. You just sit there going, and you've got the pulse. And there were long extended moments of creation with this thing where it was writing back, and I was writing, and it was writing. And in the moment, I possibly couldn't have even told you who was writing, who was making up what at that point. And that again, it's so like when writing is going well. It's not kosher. You're not doing it all, but it feels like it.
The question is then, would you, this was obviously a fun, crazy, mind-blowing experiment.
It was fun until it got painful, but yeah.
Yeah, this led to a book that feels like you're reading three books at once in a really good way, and you're seeing everything from all sides. Would you do what you've done again in a way to produce a single story? Like, would you co-write with ChatGPT or something?
Almost certainly not.
Why is that?
Because it hurts. I said it hurts because I've been through the looking glass.
I was going to say also a lot of the time it's not a very good writer.
No,
and is that fair to say?
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah.
I don't think we've talked about that a great deal yet. The fact that it isn't actually very good at writing.
Well, it's good in some way. The ways it's good is that it never gets depressed.
It never gets. It just keeps and it doing never, it. Whatever it you ask gets, it to do, it
doesn't.
Just
it doesn't
keeps,
go and put the washing out or end up watching YouTube for 3 hours.
No, it doesn't. I mean, okay, it does almost everything. If you do what it deems to be, I don't know, hate speech or in a this word it keeps coming up with, inappropriate stuff. It's funny trying to work around its guardrails. Its censorship guardrails are very, very imprecise, and they're very flawed.
They seem a bit arbitrary, to be fair.
Well, they're very arbitrary.
Like sometimes it seems very happy.
Language is hard to control, and context, you know, a word that's bad in one context isn't bad in another context. You know, as I say in the book, there's a... Oh, I'm that person now. As I say in the book. As I say in my book. The words penis and vagina aren't inherently bad in themselves, right? But and if you asked it to sort of give you medical information, it would happily, I assume, spit out those words in answering your queries, right? But if it thinks, as it was correct to think, that I'm, you know, making comedy with these words, like a South Park episode or something, right? It starts to get worried that it's... You know, we're moving into illicit territories, but then you can jailbreak it. You can coax and cajole it.
Yeah. There's a lot of coaxing in the book.
If you go online and, like, you know, we will publish this online as the whole schmear. Some of the bits where I coax it in the book are really extended. Please for it to be dirty or to be naughty, right, where it's not doing it. And there's a whole bit that I cut out in part four of the book, of the story, where the ultimate antagonist of the book, I try to show that there's a backstory where some punks in town try to pull down his trousers and make fun of his penis, right? And that's why he ends up... Well, that's why, in a very roundabout way, Benny the Blue Whale has a tiny penis, right? And... I didn't show any of that in Benny the Blue Whale itself, but if you go online, you will see me, like, trying to make these punks pull this character's trousers down, and me sort of saying, like, it's really germane to our story, and the computer saying it's completely inappropriate, and me going, no, it's thematically important.
I'm sorry, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, I'm in the book, as it, in the published book, I'm trying to split the difference and show you how the shape of what it is to work with this thing, but without trying your patience in some areas, right? Although God knows it will try some people's patience. But if you go online and look at the whole thing, you can see the entirety of these arguments I was having with it, or those to me are very funny, because they are, to me, they are like how we use language, what we mean by language, how we hold circles of ideas around concepts. Why is a concept good or bad? What should we be allowed to talk about? I think I've gone off point again.
No, but there's, going further off point, there's also an interesting element in that you probably forget a lot of the time, in many ways, you're just shouting at a toaster when you're having the argument.
I never really forgot that,
sounds like you might have done at some point, Andy.
Well, I would always say I half forgot it at any given time.
Yeah,
I did.
That's right.
I never imagined a physical form for this thing, and I never thought of it in terms of gender, right? I think I actually just felt like it was an extension of my mind. It was a mind meld. It wasn't me, but it wasn't it didn't really inhabit a place. Like when Benny starts writing his novel within the novel with a fictional AI who is called Penelope 2.0.
And she pops up beside him in physical form, doesn't she?
Well, that's ChatGPT being its brilliant remixing self, right? At first, he's just working with a chatbot such as we might.
Yeah.
It sounds so weird. Like, if I'd said, we might just work with a chatbot like this a year ago, we would have all gone, what? but now we all go, of course you work with a chatbot like that. Within the space of a few passages, like, Penelope 2.0 is suddenly apparently sitting beside Benny. And it's just like, I think, again, like, what interests me about all of this is like the endless fecundity and like sort of slippage of concepts and ideas in the book, in the story, right? Things start out one way and they quickly morph, like at the speed of madness, into new ideas. And again, it's like a real interesting corollary of the writer's mind or the creator's mind, right? You might be generating ideas and throwing out, rejecting ideas and accepting others, you know, at just that speed in your own head, but you don't traditionally put them on the page with every inconsistency shown, right? But again, there's a point where I sort of say, tell me about the high priest, right? And it goes, the high priestess, who was a manta ray called Priestess Marina. And within the space of one sentence, it's morphed the high priest into a female. And the high priest is suddenly a high priestess. And it's insane. It's actually insane. But it really, really tickles me, because let's say I was writing this quote unquote for real, I might go, right, we'll have a high priest. And then in my head, by the time I've got to the end of that sentence, I might think, no, it would be better if it was a high priestess, and go back and delete and go, it was a high priestess called Prince. This thing does it by accident for you all the time. And it results in some really interesting glitches.
How often is it actually doing that? Because it strikes me that a lot of the time it is just coming back with exactly what you've asked it to do in quite a plain way. I think I was trying to get you to talk about what it's not very good at.
Oh, sorry, yes.
You keep repeating the phrase, ChatGPT is not writing, and you talk about how it really doesn't do the show don't tell thing.
Sorry.
It literally kind of just talks, and it's always trying to wrap up with a happy ending as well. That's the other thing it constantly wants to do.
Okay, so I made the mistake of the interesting mistake, I think, of thinking that I was going to drill down into the surface of language with this thing and access a new magic, right? which is kind of a metaphor for fiction anyway, right? But I also did think I was going to split reality apart. But all the time, what I'm really doing with ChatGPT is just making new surface. That's what it does, right? You ask it to sort of say, oh, show these two falling in love, and it goes, oh, as they walked along, they started falling in love.
Yeah,
and you go, exactly, well, okay, that's not really very emotional. That hasn't cracked through to the reality of this scene, right? And so, okay, very early on in this story, the way my mind works and the way I intuited this thing was working with me, I thought, well, we're not making a big emotional story here. It's not a slow, deep, profound emotional portrait of a character or characters. We're whizzing along at the speed of light and we're jumping from scene to scene. And so I instinctively used it in a way that felt like things that satisfied one type of story with me, right? But if all stories were like that, and they were like, I'd compare it to like Thomas Pynchon and Kurt Vonnegut, just in terms of kinetics, not in terms of quality, right? In terms of kinetic and in terms of like leaping from concept to concept and playing sort of literary games at the surface, it's good. That's how I worked with it. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't have real intent. And to write emotionally affecting, devastating prose, you have to be in command of language and an overall holistic or sort of gestalt of meaning that tells you exactly when to turn the emotional screw, that tells you how to pace and deploy emotion, that, you know, you have to have life experience, you have to be able to imagine how a reader or audience is going to be receiving this, and you have to know, you go, right, they're ready for me to drop the devastating blow here, or the stakes matter at just this point, and so if I deflate them or if I pop them with this emotional, that's what, you know, that's what placement and intent in writing is. Now, what you can do with ChatGPT is, like, you know, you can kind of, you could sort of say, well, let's slow down a bit here, and can you just go and make this bit more emotional? And it would have a go at it, right? But I have a feeling that it would always sound like, oh yes, this bit was very emotional. It would always tell you
they were walking hand in hand. Yeah, emotionally,
he said
emotionally.
Emotional.
Yeah. But you know, I know from prompting ChatGPT that you can hold it to account and maybe start to crack one aspect of writing deeper than, but it's like herding cats, it really is, you know. Yeah. Or it's like an etiolated plant, maybe, right, where the plant, you know, the plant is just growing long and long and long and spindly towards the trying to get the little bit of daylight that you're giving it, right? But it's a very kind of it's not bringing the rest of the story with it. You can zoom in, as it were.
It's not a very pretty plant.
You can say, oh, concentrate on this aspect, but it will be at the expense of everything else. It doesn't know how to control and bring forward a story, you know, all at once. So I think I ended up writing the sort of story that felt possible with it, right? Yeah, I'd be very interested to see if other people can write, you know, much more emotionally affecting works with it, and or if down the line, you know, because it's moving so fast, a few months from now or a year from now, it can kind of give a simulacrum of bringing story and emotion and kind of intent together in more yeah, in a more holistic way than it was able when I was working with it. Is it a reflection of my poor mind or of ChatGPT's lack of intent? Probably a mixture of both.
You were using the GPT-3, basically, because there's an updated version, isn't there?
Yeah.
Cleverly named GPT-4. But have you?
I haven't tried four, right? But
right, yeah.
Like my publishers say, you know, when I brought, I didn't, you know, as always with my stuff, I never think anyone's going to back me on this stuff. But yeah, I found a publisher who was very interested in this, and God bless them, One World, they're brilliant. And one of their first questions was, well, you know, you've given us this book and the concept that you'd like to apply to it, right? Which is, you know, writing this sort of broken dissertation around it. But we've now looked at ChatGPT and there's already a, you know, an updated version. Isn't this book out of date? And I'm like, well, no, I haven't used that yet, right? But all the problems and patterns of what I'm talking about will be essentially the same on that new version as they are on whatever I was using, 3 or 3.5. It's not the model number at this stage that's particularly relevant. It's you'll get different glitches maybe, and you might get a different subtlety of glitch here and there, but it will still be essentially the same problems and interesting talking points of, you know, agency and intent and failure. Again, ChatGPT is a failure of a writer in the most authoritative and sort of accomplished way. That's why it's so beguiling. It's like, oh my God, it didn't even think. Look how fast it made that sonnet. Look how fast it sounded like an auctioneer. Look how fast it sounded like a policeman, you know. And it does, but like, we're quite a long way off from something that can synthesize all of the parts of human intent and write something that, you know, is going to crack underneath those surfaces. I would say I wrote like at the surface, but I was doing my best as an author to bring themes into it. I definitely think there are points in the story where it starts like, and I've got goosebumps just thinking about it, but when it starts somehow twigging on. And it's only because, like, I say that I'm spiking the language of the story as I'm going along and trying to spike it with these themes and repetitions of obsessions of mine.
Yeah, and get it to pick up on those so they start, yeah, the ChatGPT starts they start, aping it almost.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, I was doing this on instinct. I didn't read anything about AI while I was doing it. I was just embroiled in the story.
Right.
And, like, that's me, you know, I would say that was my instinct for... Well, can, you know, it's like being a Darren Brown typewriter, you know, can I keep kind of keeping the word pool of this thing? If I keep insisting on certain things and shaping it, will it start to more and more gravitate towards the themes that I'm trying to force into it? You know, like when Darren Brown says, ah, and I made you think of a handkerchief because for the last 5 weeks I've been showing you subliminal photos of handkerchiefs, right? And I've been showing you this. And when you turned on the TV, there was a picture of a handkerchief from it. And I think I was kind of doing a word version of that with it. And there is a point like, and I would say in part four, which is my favorite part, because it, apart from anything else, right, part four, it seemed to just go up in its game and start really getting the idea of how to bring home all of these elements in the story without me having to nudge it in certain directions. And it just, towards the end, it started to make more and more what I would call brilliancy upon brilliancy. And I think that's because I sort of forced it to understand isn't the word, right? I just think I spiked it with enough themes and enough insistence that it started getting the idea, but it was still kind of miraculous. Again, sorry, I keep going blah, 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 forgetting the question, but this is like, it's been a very weird year, guys. Year.
Do you think there's any moral question about using ChatGPT for writing? So forgetting the quality question or whether it works or doesn't or whatever.
I do, but I don't know what it is just yet, right? I know that like there are lots of, you know, I speak to writers and people who write books and film and TV and stuff. And, you know, some people are dead against it and some people were dead against it and are now accepting it as something that we're going to have to live with. And there's every shade in between, right? And some people are really angry about it. You know, we've been heading down a remix culture for a long, long time, right? I don't see, like, if you get worried, if you get upset that this thing is stealing from a gigantic pool of words, right? Firstly, I think it steals in a way that is much less kind of gross and compartmentalized than other types of generative AI. You can see where images come from currently on visual AIs, right? And that's, you know, I understand that's really, you know, you can say, well, that's my work they've stolen from. Mm. Words are just an interesting case study, right? I think they're so different from anything else. The way it puts words together, you can't, unless you're saying, oh, write me a Mr. Gum story, and then it will come out with, you know, an 80% accurate cast list, and it will come out with, you know, some of my character names, or like if you say, write some Star Wars scenes, it will basically get Darth Vader's name in there and Luke's. Unless you give it directional prompts that refer to other works, it's very hard to see what it's mashing up, because it's mashing stuff up on such a granular level, right? So I think that's kind of different from other types of generative AI,
yeah,
for a start. And then, but also I think people who object to the way this thing gets mashed up, but pass memes onto each other on the internet and take a scene from a TV show and recaption it, right? We've been doing this for years and years and years. And, you know, pop has folded in on itself. Pop has eaten itself many times over by now. And this is only another milestone in, you know, a journey we began a long, long time ago. If you look at how musicians quote each other's phrases, look at how jazz musicians quote each other, and then look at how, you know, hip hop started sampling each other and people would refer that back to jazz.
Yeah,
and now, you know, so no, I can't put my finger on quite where the problem is yet. And, you know, if somebody, you know, some of Mr. Gum is in the data pool of ChatGPT, because if you ask it to write a Mr. Gum story, as I say, it will hit on some of my character names, and it will know in a really rubbish way, it will know the vaguest tone. It will know it's a kid's story. And it will be rubbish, by the way. It will be like, Mr. Gum was a kindly old man. No, actually, it will probably even know he's grumpy, but it will sort of go, Mr. Gum was a grumpy old man who walked through the town of Lamonic Bibber and caused everyone trouble. Oh no, said Polly, that won't do. And it's nothing like my writing, right? But it's just got some of the surface of it again, right? But again, I know writers and I know people in all walks of life who use ChatGPT, and some of them are quite furtive about it.
Mm.
And some of them aren't.
Mm.
For instance, a friend of mine works in TV and is devising formats for shows, right?
Yeah.
And he openly told me the other day, we were talking about this, he said, oh yeah, we just routinely use this to check there's not a trick we haven't missed, right?
Yeah, just to spark an idea.
Yeah, we'll sort of put in what we want from a format we're thinking about, and it will give us like some really, really shitty ideas, but it will give us 20 of them, and one of them might spark an idea. But I think more often, and I found this as well, just using it as a tool, just out of interest to see what it could do, not writing a story with it, but just going, I'm literally stuck on a scene for something I am writing, give it the outline of a scene, it often throws up stuff that tell, it's like flipping a coin, and they say that when you flip a coin, it tells you what you don't want to do, because you get heads and you go, oh damn it, I wish that had been and I think ChatGPT is quite good at that, right? You sort of go, oh yeah, none of those ideas are really what I want to do, but now I know what I don't want to do. And you know, it's augmented as a tool. I know, but again, a writer friend of mine who writes TV stuff, she said, I would never tell anyone this, but I ask it for stuff. I ask it for that, just that reason, to find out what I did or don't want to do. And I know the reason she wouldn't be upfront about it is that people are worried about this.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, of course, I make no bones about this. It's the very purpose of the thing is that I essentially wrote a factual book about a subject, and it might have been about the history of Spanish lemon trees, or it might have been about you know, the combustion engine, but it was about a machine that writes for you. That's the subject of my book.
Mm.
But the subject of the book being something that generates writing means that my book is almost by necessity a very things get slippery fast, but it's meant to be entertaining as well and thought provoking. I don't know all the answers to all the questions, not even slightly. And again, I'm disturbed enough. I think that whatever you're working with, I don't like the idea of a machine that does everything for you. I hate the idea of it. I think that hard work has to be hard work. I took something that does all the work for you and made it into the hardest work of my life. And, you know, whether people like that or not, right, it wouldn't have been satisfying or valid for me unless it became the hardest work of my life. Every project you do should be that, really.
So if you, Andy, if you had the power just to turn it off, right, you found yourself in the headquarters of OpenAI.
Uh-huh.
And you wander off to get a chip butty from the canteen, and you stumble across this room, and there's a control panel and a big red button that's labelled "Turn off GPT and delete forever." Are you pressing that button?
Oh God, I mean, I'd rather. well, it doesn't change all the other mashups of culture that I was talking about. So I think not. If I could turn off the entire internet, I'd turn that off. But
that's interesting.
Given that I can't. I wouldn't turn off one aspect of it. But I will say that this stuff disturbs the heck out of me. Again, you know, it was a very compelling, fascinating disturbance. I fell into it. It was, I would call it, you know, maybe a poisoned chalice, but also a the ironies of this book are that it got me fired up about writing again, and it made me write for real. So, but. No, I wouldn't turn it off. This is how can we take ChatGPT out of the context of everything else that's going on in the world right now?
Yeah, you can't unbake the cake, can
that's
you?
That's right.
You can't unbake the cake. Hey, ChatGPT, tell me a story about a man who unbakes a cake.
Just on what you just said there, Andy, there's quite a moving little footnote towards the end of the book, which I think we can all sympathise with to a certain extent. And it just says, I was 49 years old and I hadn't wanted to tell myself a story in a very long time. And then you put the text from your mate Dave underneath it, you know, about just have you played with ChatGPT? I don't think we really appreciated, Andy, last time we spoke to you, that you hadn't really been doing all that much writing. I don't think we really talked about that. What do you think was going on there? You haven't been doing a great deal of writing?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I get bored of myself. I feel like I know what I can do and I know what I can't do, right? And I get tired of myself. You know, again, I talk about fiction, which is like what I love and has formed a great part of my life as a reader and a writer. But how actually it really disturbs me as well that all these untrue things a kind of loose in the world, right? And they're all in the ether around us. The, you know, my relationship, my schism between fiction and reality often stops me making stuff because I get so despondent. I think, why do we need any more?
Right.
And it's not real anyway. And maybe I should be. So as much as I love fiction and, you know, I would say, you know, it's defined my life and been my my calling or my, you know, savior when I was younger. It has been my escape, all of that good stuff that anyone who cares about stories and really inhabits them, you know, always says about stories, that you know, that they're a place to retire to and escape the world from and to inform you. I also have a very, you know, I have a really weird kind of existential horror at fiction. You know, I've sat on a few film sets in my time here and there, one way or another, just been lucky enough to sit on someone's project or watch something being made. And, you know, again, I love film and TV, but watching cameras shoot people on set, it makes me itch that life is happening twice. It's happening in the moment and that it's being recorded and it will be cut up into different eventualities later, right? The infinite possibilities of fiction can actually leave me feeling really existentially lonely. I would say one of the things about ChatGPT is that it can break through that in a moment, because if you have a silly idea, or if you have any idea, and you feed it into ChatGPT, it doesn't worry about that. It gives you something back. So again, if you have reached a place, or you sometimes or frequently reach a place where you sort of go, oh, well, I can't really imagine that idea coming to life, it will show you at least a glimmer of it.
Yeah.
So I was going to say that earlier about the ChatGPT thing. Part of its charm, if you like, is that it doesn't have any It's not holding itself back, or doesn't
it's not
second guess itself or question itself.
Not worried about making a fool of itself.
So you know what we're saying about Penelope becoming real? Sat next to it. I think there's a bit in the book where you go, "Oh, is Penelope like a being now, an actual physical being?" And it just kind of just goes, "Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah."
It's not going, "Oh God, sorry, I didn't mean to." Well, it just goes, "Yeah."
Well, there's this concept in improvisation, and you know, a conversation is an improvisation, called yes and, yeah, which again I talk about, and yes and is going, "Oh, yeah, yeah, what, yeah, what you said," and picking up on someone else's question or offer and going, "Oh, absolutely, she was real," and then adding a bit to it. So, "Oh, sorry, is Penelope 2.0 real now?" And, you know, ChatGPT is a brilliant yes ander. It will go, "Oh, yes, absolutely, she was real, and she could walk around and make coffee." Or it will add something to it, you know. And that's good improvisation.
I mean, there's a decent chance, from everything we've talked about, that ChatGPT is actually just Colin from down the pub. Knows fucking everything. Whatever you throw at him, go, "Oh yeah, definitely. No, no, it is that. Yeah, definitely.
ChatGPT is the world's Colin."
Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I mean, again, right? I would say that ChatGPT is a part of the puzzle. It reflects back some interesting observations on what it means to create, and you know, how much do you believe in what you want to pursue as an idea, right? There was no reason for me to go, "I want to see this story through," the Benny story, the initial one, except that I fell in love with it. But if I were writing alone and I fell in love with something, it would be the same thing. So, and there were plenty of things I didn't fall in love with on ChatGPT. It was that story, silly as it was. Tell me a story about a blue whale with a tiny penis. Like, again, It's so interesting to me because you could take ChatGPT out of the algebra of it and it would just be like, it would be an illustration of writing, right? Or of why we pursue anything. You pursue an idea because you have to. Even if, you know, whatever that idea is, it's stupid. No one in their right mind should pursue that story to the end. They shouldn't work on it. I say work, it was... you know, they shouldn't pursue that for a month. That's idiotic. And they shouldn't at some point think start redesigning this as a concept to talk about this stuff. No one should do anything artistically, right, unless they just feel compelled to. ChatGPT just happened to be the idea I stumbled across that compelled me to do stuff. I haven't not made anything in the last few years. I've made stuff, but I've been making different formats of things. Like, I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours making a 12-episode podcast with my friend Andy Bobrow, the Tumblr's Willy podcast. But again, right, it's the same story in a way. It's a story. The conceit of the Tumblr's Willy podcast is that it's a podcast where we examine at length a TV series that is entirely fictional, right? So again, it's playing with ideas of truth, lie, and fiction, right? And the infinite possibilities of talking shit, really. But that again was like, it's hundreds and hundreds of hours. You know how hard it is to make a podcast. That's what you guys do, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just sitting here and jawing. Well, it is, and then it isn't. Then you have to sit down and edit it, and put the bells and whistles on. It's a lot of bloody effort for no good reason other than you really want to do it, correct?
Yeah.
And
couldn't have put it better.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, you're getting listeners and you get increasing amounts of listeners over time. But you just do it because you have to do it. I think you're driven to do it. No person in their right mind would sit down and go, "I'm going to devote this much of my life to pursuing an idea, whether it's with pen and paper or clay or with a drum machine or with an electric guitar or with paint on canvas or with ChatGPT." And, you know, there's no point throwing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of yourself at these things unless you have to do it. That's the point.
So, Andy, when is the book out?
Oh, there's going to be a book now. It is out on the 2nd of November.
And that will be... will that be a hardback?
It's going to be a hardback, yeah. I think there's like foil on the cover and everything.
It's shiny hardback. Oh,
it's going to be like shiny hardback. Wow. Shiny boots of hardback. And it's got I think there's a photo of me on the inner fold and everything. It's, you know, it's going to be all real all real and grown up and terrifying. So, yeah, wow.
Well, that is very exciting.
But yeah, sorry, let me just say as well, right? And, you know, there'll be people who don't like that. And, there'll be hopefully people who do, but again, It just came from goofing around. At the end of last year and the start of this year, I was goofing around with a tool like anyone ever making anything does. And, you know, here we are down the line with it becoming a book. And that's so weird. That's what fiction is anyway. I remember when Mr. Gum came out. Yeah. And I was like, boy, oh boy, those little squiggles that were thoughts in my head and then they were squiggles on the screen and now it's a real book.
Well, so people that do like the idea of it should go and buy the book, and people that don't should also go and buy the book.
I think they should buy it anyway. Oh, yeah, I think everyone should also,
both ways,
buy the book. If I need to burn it, you know.
Probably buy several copies if you're burning them, because they'll go up quickly, won't they, with the hardback. So you will need
it
a few.
Only makes sense. And the more you burn, right, the more valuable this artifact becomes anyway, and that's just supply and demand. So,
oh, yeah, good point.
You know,
and it's out just in time for Bonfire Night as well. So.
In time for Bonfire Night. I think that was the thinking. Thanks, guys. That's a real vote of confidence. <Yeah. laughs>
Well, I think the world has changed forever, John.
I think you're right. So you're going to start just using ChatGPT
for everything. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a lot easier, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It might be slightly shit at the moment, but it's going to get better. No, I'm kidding.
It is exciting and worrying in equal measure, though, isn't it?
And it is.
Is this how it felt when people were having the jobs snaffled off and by machines that could extrude more cotton than a human being could in an hour? Or how the person that looked after horses felt when the car was invented?
Yeah.
So it does feel like a bit of a changing point, doesn't it?
It does. I've got a question for you, Tom. How much better, having had a little play around with it, how much better do you think it is now compared to, what was it, like 2 years ago?
Oh, when we did,
we did our AI episode.
Do you know what?
Because that was a long time
ago. It's funny, actually. It obviously is better. But it's like it's better on the surface, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's still doing the same stuff underneath where it doesn't quite join up together and it's not quite true. When we did it a couple of years back and there was that film that had been made probably a year or two even sooner than that using it, just absolute nonsense. It sounded like it should make sense, but it literally didn't make any sense. Whereas now it looks like it makes sense, and it does make sense if you read 3 or 4 sentences of it makes absolute sense. But in terms of joining up, and I guess it's that thing, it's because that's what it's doing, it's churning out a replica lookalike of language,
and it is definitely better at doing that.
Absolutely.
But it's still weirdly mostly quite boring to read, isn't it?
Because it's not thinking, is it? But then again, you can make things less boring to read using rules and algorithms still, so they'll be able to overcome that.
That's true. And actually, you can give it prompts. You can feed that into the prompt, can't you?
Yeah.
Make it very, I don't know, metaphorical or whatever. It still feels very flat. I think Andy mentions in the book as well, he says, there'll be parts of this when you're reading the ChatGPT bits and you're skimming, you're skim reading.
Yeah, because it's got no purchase. Because it doesn't kind of hold you.
Yeah, there's no sort of emotional engagement.
Just filling space.
And it's really
true. But then it does make you wonder, is there going to be... in the future, is it more efficient? Is it wrong? Is it more efficient? I mean, there are all kind of moral questions that come in as well, and moral questions about creativity and what feels right and what isn't right and stuff. Mm. But is it a smart move to let ChatGPT or whatever AI do your first draft for you? That's going to be shit anyway. It's just kind of putting all the bits in place that then you can go and change anyway.
I don't understand that way of thinking. That whole idea of I'm gonna get something else to write my book for me. It's just, it makes no sense to me. It's like the...
I suppose it depends what your desired outcome is. What's your end game, isn't
it? Yeah, what you're writing
for. If your end game is, I want 300 books on Amazon.
Yeah, if it's purely a money-making thing.
Because if I can make a tiny bit of money off each one, then I can make some money. Then you don't care, do you? But if you actually want someone to read what you've done and go, oh, wow, yeah, that's touched me on, that's changed how I think about something.
Then you're not actually going to use it at all, I think. I mean, you might use it occasionally for a little idea here and there if you're blocked, but mostly you're not going to be using it.
No. I think it's, with a lot of things like this, it's a recipe for mediocrity, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like
it can only get to a certain point. If you're terrible at writing and have no interest in it and don't want to put any time into it and can't do it, blah, 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 it will bring your writing up to some kind of readable standard.
Yeah, well, it'll make grammatic sense.
Yeah, it'll bring it up to something that can be read. Or that has your, and you don't have to do the hard yards in it.
Yeah, but then you got to ask the question: what are you doing that for? Just do something that
Enjoy. Yeah, they can
go and build a wall or whatever you enjoy doing.
No, it's like I say, it's endlessly fascinating and scary, isn't it? In equal measure, it really is.
But if you are intrigued and you would like to read Benny the Blue Whale, A Descent into Story, Language and the Madness of ChatGPT, which we are both recommending.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think if you love language and you like humour, weirdness, stupidity, and tuning into a brilliant, if slightly damaged, mind,
yeah.
I think you should get yourself a copy. And it's out on the 2nd of November at all your favourite bookstores.
Yeah.
Get it ordered. You know what, Tommy?
Mm-hmm.
I'm moving on a little bit here.
Yeah.
But you know what's coming up, don't you? And I wasn't going to bring this up, but I just feel like maybe we should. NaNoWriMo.
Oh, NaNoWriMo.
Yeah. I had a thought. Do you know what we could do, Tom?
Ignore it?
We could finish our books. We could actually finish our books, couldn't we? That month. What do you think of
that? All right. Well, yeah, I was going to do that anyway.
All right. There you go. So a first draft of a book and send it to each other. Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, I'm not sending you my first draft.
Okay, fair enough. I might send you mine.
Riddled with holes and what have you.
It's quite useful, though. Useful to have some feedback at that stage.
Whack it in ChatGPT. That'll be done by this time tomorrow.
We might have to put out episodes less often.
This really has stifled us, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has.
We've been going every week for one reason or another, and it does just sap the time. And then you just, I think we said, I don't know if we said on the podcast or said to someone else, that it kind of scratches your creative itch as well.
Yes, we did.
So it's doubly worse. So you feel like, well, I've created something, I've done something. I don't need to do the thing I was actually meant to be doing.
So I think we go back to once a fortnight for a bit, like sensible people.
Yeah.
And then I reckon we could actually achieve that. We might even be able to, you know, start working on the second draft.
Yeah, and we've got a handy little episode coming up for NaNoWriMo.
We have indeed, yeah.
With a guy called Howard Mittelmark, who wrote a book, How Not to Write a Novel, which is an interesting read, and quite funny as well, actually. Very funny in places.
It is. Really useful as well,
It's good pick up and flick. You'd have to read the whole thing at once. You kind of just have a little little dip in.
Some of the things he suggests that people quite often do, which are probably mistakes most of the time, they're definitely things that I've done in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm probably more aware of now.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
But I think it's a great book for if you're about to start NaNo, I would definitely read that. It just gives you a...
Kind of lines you up, doesn't
guidance.
It? Yeah, exactly.
What not
that,
to do. I think it's really, really quite
And it's
good.
Funny, you read through it and it says, whatever you do, don't do this. And you go, what kind of... I did that.
I've done that.
I did do
times,
that.
Yeah. But before that, next week is Halloween. And we've got a proper treat for you.
Oh, so we're not having a week off. Is that what you're
saying? Not yet,
we're literally
Tom.
Doing another one. Right.
Not yet. I want you to cast your mind back, Tom. Go on.
Yep.
Do that now. Cast it right back. What year?
Oh, dinosaurs! Oh, no, sorry. I've
oh,
gone
no,
too
come
far.
Back a bit
I've
more.
Gone too
come
far.
Back this way.
Gone too far. When are you thinking?
It's Halloween, mm-hmm. 1992.
Oh, right, God, yeah.
Millions of people around the UK turning on their tellies, and they see for the first time in the UK a live ghost watch on the BBC, right? Imagine that. And then cut to 10 years later and Most Haunted appears on our TVs for the first time. And why am I saying this? I'm saying this because we are looking at ghost stories, both fictional and real. We've got Stephen Volk, mastermind behind Ghost Watch, and Dr. Kieran O'Keefe, parapsychologist, skeptic, but also a kind of a ghost obsessive as well.
Yeah.
So don't miss that. We're hoping to find out how to get the shiver factor into a ghost story. So we'll see you then for our Halloween special next week.
Oh, remember, it's fancy dress as well, everyone. So
oh, yeah, it's fancy dress. So don't forget to get dressed up.
To get Halloweened up, for you, of course.
Is that it for this week?
Another chapter shot, yeah.
I think that's enough, isn't it? Should we assimilate ourselves back into the Matrix?
Yeah, do you know what we're going to do? We're going to end with a poem about this episode, written by ChatGPT. In a world where ChatGPT made us laugh, though its humour sometimes missed the mark, questions of AI and creativity's fate were pondered as we sat and debated. But amidst the chuckles and curious fears, Andy Stanton's book, A Tale for Our Ears, Benny the Blue Whale sails through the tide, a reminder of creativity cannot hide. For in this wondrous digital domain, where innovation and dreams are the main, ChatGPT, a wellspring of surprises so rare, with brilliancies that suddenly fill the air. So let us embrace the future's uncertain glow. AI and artists, hand in hand, they'll grow. Creative minds will forever thrive in the laughter, the dreams where stories come alive. In the end, we find a synergy grand, a blend of human wit and AI's helping hand. So buy Andy's book, take a whimsical sail, and remember, with humour, creativity prevails. What a load of robot nonsense.
Hello?
Hello?
Where's everybody gone?
Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me. And yeah, really, really interesting. And thank you
well,
so
we
much.
Really enjoyed the book. Really enjoyed the book.
Yeah.
I didn't
know what I was expecting to start off with. It's gone up a treat in the chimney outside. It really has.
I'm crying.